Welcome to Scoop and Scale, where we dish up the science and weigh facts about mostly equine nutrition. I'm Michelle Anderson. I spent 2 decades working in equine media, and I currently create content and help veterinarians and businesses connect with horse owners through my consulting business, Cadence Marketing and Media. I'm a trail rider, dressage rider, and an at-home horse keeper.
And I'm equine nutrition consultant, Dr. Claire Tunis of Clarity Equine Nutrition. I develop diet plans for horses ranging from metabolic seniors to Olympic athletes. I also consult for equine nutrition companies. I'm a scientist, dressage rider, and a pony club mom.
Claire and I collaborated for years when I was the editor of an equine publication, and she was one of our regular contributors. We'd finished work, but we always had more to talk about. New products, new research, and our own horses. This podcast is an extension of those conversations. It's for anyone who wants to make better choices when it comes to feeding and caring for their own horses.
And before we get started, a quick disclaimer. The information in this podcast is general and not meant to replace the individualized advice of your own qualified equine nutritionist or veterinarian. While I have a PhD in nutrition, I'm not a veterinarian and can't give medical advice.
With that, thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the following episode. Getting a new horse can be really exciting. But for the horse, a new owner can mean lots of change and stress. A new home, a new routine, new people, new friends.
They might not be friends. I think they might think they're enemies sometimes.
Those transitions can be hard. And combined, these changes and the stress can increase a horse's risk of serious health issues, such as gastric ulcers and colic. That's why taking steps to reduce changes in diet and other stress when getting a new horse is so important. Claire, you are going through this right now. You just got your new horse. You want to tell us a little bit about him?
I did, yes. It's very exciting. My daughter's had a horse for, golly, about 4 years now. This is the first time I've actually owned my own horse for a very long time.
I thought this was your daughter's horse.
No, this one's mine. Although I have a feeling it'll get stolen. So yeah, there's a little bit of a plan that she'll end up riding it. But anyway, for now, he's mine. But yes, he is a 3/4 thoroughbred Holstein across. He was an event horse and I purchased him to do dressage on. What a surprise. Because that's what you and I like to do. Yes. But yeah, so he'll be 9 next month and he's shown all over the West Coast, evented out through preliminary and always scored very nicely in the dressage phase of eventing and has a nice aptitude for it. He's very sweet, but he was bred and raised and owned for his, 8 years by the same person. So it's a big change for him. And he's been pretty much in the same barn, my understanding is, a very large part of his life as well. So to move, although, he didn't move terribly far, like 6 hours, it's all new to him. And we've been chuckling about things like, I don't know that he's ever seen chickens before or a goat. And the neighbor has a retaining wall that their black and white goat likes to stand on. And I have a picture of this new horse looking at the goat. And I swear, I looked at him and I thought, oh my gosh, I bought a saddlebred, right? I mean, he's just standing there with his head up, kind of, looking very upright. I mean, it looks very handsome, but
yeah, I was going to say a saddlebred. I'm currently riding a half saddlebred pre-St.
Yeah,
George
no, they can make
saber.
Dressage. I've seen some great saddlebred cross dressage horses, but anyway, it was just so funny. And the chickens, I mean, I think he thought they were like little prehistoric monsters. So it's definitely been a little stressful for him kind of adapting to living in what I think he thinks is something very rural. And I keep trying to explain him, no, this is suburbia. This is, this is not rural. Anyway, so yeah, it has been stressful. And yeah. It noticeably took him a good 10 days to kind of relax. And it was interesting. You could tell, I have a good sort of 30-yard walk from his stall to the cross ties. And it was really interesting paying attention to the horse I had making that walk every day. And, it really took about 10 days for him to come out and his like pole to be at the height of my shoulders and just be kind of like, I know where we're going. We're going to go to the cross ties. Prior to that, he was like, I know where we're going. Are the chickens going to be there? Is there going to be a goat? Is the neighbor's FFA pig going to be out for a walk? It was all like high alert the whole time. So it really took a while.
Yeah, I think we are so focused on our needs and our excitement about this that it can be easy to forget about the horse and how much change is going on in their life. We think they might be as excited as we are about our new adventures.
Right.
But I think it really turns their lives upside down, especially when they've been in a place long-term like yours. And I don't know, and there's no scientific backing to this, I don't think, but my mare, I think that was really hard on her to leave her friends that she had been with. I think that mares are pretty well bonded when they're in mare herds, and it took her a while to settle in and know that this was her new place and her new people and new horse friends. And she has a frenemy. My other mare is her frenemy, so you're right.
Yeah.
But as a nutritionist, I think that you shopping for a horse, you might see things that are different than those of us who aren't an equine nutritionist.
Yeah. I mean, I get clients who come to me who've bought a new horse, and I'm always shocked how little they often know of how the horse was being fed. You know, and it's like, I think we know, I mean, you know, I was a pony clubber, my daughter's a pony clubber, and we have these rules of feeding you learn at a very early age and stage of your pony club life. And the rules of feeding, and one of those rules of feeding is make feed changes gradually over 7 to 10 days. And I think we all know that. The science supports that, that your colic risk goes up when you make a hay change for like 3 weeks afterwards. And yet somehow we go buy a new horse and we bring it home and we just feed it whatever we decide to feed it. And I'm always like, ah, you know, it's like, that's about the most sudden feed change. And in addition to all sorts of other stress, right? It's not even just a feed change in the horse's normal routine and you just changed its feed. You've changed its routine. As you said, its friends, its owner.
How it's being ridden.
How it's being trained, the expectation, I mean, everything. So, you know, if there was one time that I wouldn't want to make a feed change, it's when I buy a horse. And so I'm always very surprised how little information people often ask sellers about how horses are being fed. And it's actually a conversation I had pretty early.
Yeah. So what kind of questions did you ask about how your horse was being fed? And was that before you made an offer?
Yeah. No, I mean, it came up in casual conversation and, you know, just kind of what it was being fed. Was he on any supplements? And, you know, at that point, we didn't get into like the nitty gritty of it, but, you know, was he on any supplements? Did he need any grain or anything? And yeah, they shared that he had Smart Pack, something for his feet and something for gut health. They couldn't quite remember, you know, exactly what it was he was getting. But yeah, but I mean, at least I had some sense of, okay, this horse gets some dietary maintenance. I don't know. Maintenance is like that funny word, right? That comes up when you're horse shopping. Everyone's always, oh, maintenance. I don't know whether you call gut supplements and things nutritional maintenance, but yeah.
But I would say, so if I heard, well, the horse is getting a hoof supplement, that, because I'm interested in, like, you're interested in nutrition. I'm interested in nutrition too. I don't have a PhD, but I have an interest in feet because right. I do a lot, you know, I do my own trimming. And so my ears would perk to that. This horse right. gets a hoof supplement. Why does the owner think they need to get a hoof supplement? So are you looking for those kind of clues?
Absolutely. Right. So, I mean, I mean, in his case, he had a couple of gut supplements. And so, yeah, that sort of made me think, huh, you know, why does he have those gut supplements? Like, does he have... So it led me to then ask questions about, you know, how does he handle traveling when he's away at shows? You know, does he eat well on the road? Does he drink well on the road? Like, you know, trying to just kind of ask those kinds of things, that knowing that he gets a gut supplement would make me think about those questions. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the reality that sometimes people, A, don't remember why they give supplements. Run into that with clients and I'll ask them also, well, you know, what led you to give your horse this supplement? And there's a pregnant pause and they're like, I don't remember. Or, you know, or Sally down the barn aisle said it worked really well for her horse or whatever. Or maybe it's just, this is what your program does and everybody has to be on a gut support supplement. I mean, there are programs like that too. So it may mean nothing in particular for that horse, right?
Yeah. So I think it's probably worth a follow-up question. Like if the horse is getting vitamin E, you could say, oh, have you tested for vitamin E? Was the horse low and needed the vitamin E? Or I think like the hoof supplement would make me go like, oh, well, if the horse is shod, you know, does the horse have a tendency to throw shoes? Is there a history of cracking or abscesses or something else that people might think that a hoof supplement would fix?
Absolutely. So. And none of these things would make me necessarily not want the horse.
No.
Right. But I mean, for me, I'm a bit of a data nerd day to day in my life. And so for me, it's just the more info I can get during those early conversations while I'm trying a horse helps me build a better picture of that horse and helps me decide, is the whole picture of this horse something that I want to have in my life? Right.
Yeah. And I think your point about people maybe not knowing is important to keep in mind too, because there are people like you and I both have that analytical mind where we're going to do the things that we need to do for very specific reasons, where other people might have a more emotional reason that drives them to do things. And it's, oh, because it makes my horse happy that they like this special kind of feed that I give them. And so I wouldn't go take what the horse is getting fed as like an absolute, like the horse needs this. But like you said, it can be a clue. What about things like metabolic issues or like history of laminitis? Like, are those possibly things that you would see in how the horse is being fed?
Possibly, again, right? Certain supplements might check you into that, or choice of if they say, yes, he gets a low NSC grain or whatever, you know, that'd be like, oh, well, is there any particular reason why he's on a low NSC grain? Does he need a low NSC grain? And again, that might trigger that conversation of, oh, well, 3 years ago, he had a mild bout of laminitis or something. It's something that they weren't going to hide from you, but they weren't going to give it to you on a plate either, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. So yeah, just those conversations might come up for sure. And when you're looking at a horse, if you educate yourself about what a metabolic horse might look like, and obviously there are many metabolic horses that don't look like the stereotypical phenotype for metabolic issues with crusty neck and fat deposits and all those kinds of things, but you can just kind of casually ask as well and just say, you know, especially if it's a breed that's a little predisposed to those kinds of conditions, have there ever been any concerns?
What kind of breeds would those be, just for our listeners?
I kind of think of them as being the thrifty breeds, the kind of traditional old breeds, right? Kind of the Arabians, the Morgans, the Pasifinos, the Mustangs, the ponies, the walking horse, Tennessee walking horses and Rocky Mountain horses. Those kinds of breeds can be some of the Frisian type breeds as well. So if I'm looking at a horse that's looking a little crusty to me, or even if they're one of those breeds and they look totally normal, right? I'm going to say, have there ever been any concerns with this horse? You know, its feet, has it ever had any issues with abscesses or soreness? Or you can ask, how easy does this horse maintain his weight? That's the other thing I want to know too, right? I mean, like, I could be looking at a horse who looks like $1 million, perfect condition, but that horse might be getting 12 pounds of hard feed, you know, grain a day to stay like that.
He may be a house and a home.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And maybe I don't want that kind of feed bill. Now, some horses take that much grain in certain situations because they're stressed and they're not very happy where they live and they're burning calories and life's not great and they're harder keepers. And when you get them into your facility and your program and they get to relax and the cortisol drops and they start putting on weight with far less feed. But again, it's all information that's useful to have, right?
Yeah. So part of that investigation into what they're being fed would also include what schedule are they being fed in. And we can't all take care of horses the same as the previous place. What if you can't find the same brand of feed that that horse has been getting? Or what if the horse has been fed 4 times a day and you work at an office and you can only feed 3 times a day and there's a longer stretch in between? How do you accommodate the horse once they get to your place?
Yeah, I mean, I actually ran into that because the barn where my new horse came from, they feed 3 times a day. We feed 2x a day. So again, it was just good to have that intel. And, you know, those are situations where maybe I'm going to say, okay, I want to use some slow feed devices, maybe gets breakfast in a slow hold hay net or half loose and half in a feed ball or, you know, something so that it takes longer and he's not going to miss lunch quite so much. You know, you mentioned about what happens if you can't get the same kind of grain. You know, I would be asking if you could purchase a bag of the grain, have the horse shipped with a bag of the grain that he's been on so you can make a slow transition on the other end. Same with hay, right? That's a big one. We don't have somewhat limited types of hay in the desert. I mean, you can get timothy and orchard here, but it's really expensive because it has to come in from out of state. So, you know, we feed a lot of Bermuda and alfalfa and things. And so this horse that I purchased was getting orchard and alfalfa. And I had the conversation with the seller and about what was he getting. So this is after I had, you know, at this point, I'd agreed to buy the horse, right? So the initial conversations were pretty vague and, you know, whatever. Now we're getting into the nitty gritty of, okay, I'm about to buy this horse. How much hay does it get? What kind of hay does it get? How much grain does it get? What's the routine? And they disclosed that they actually had Bermuda at their facility. And so I asked them if they would be willing to transition him to Bermuda at that point, because I wasn't going to be able to get him transported for a week. And so we actually transitioned him from Orchard onto Bermuda the week before he shipped, so that that diet change happened in his home environment before he was subjected to any stress. And so that was nice. But if they hadn't been able to do that, I would have purchased one or two bales of their hay from them and had him ship with that hay so that I could do the transition slowly.
So I hear often about horses that have been purchased from other parts of the country, and you have different climates in different places. And with the stress, like if a horse is from the northern part of the US and then get sold or moved or taken just even to show, like down in Florida, for example, then the horse will start having issues like insect bite hypersensitivity, or maybe their asthma will kick up, and things that are related to immune system. And immune system's connected to nutrition and gut health. So what kind of things might you recommend that someone do when they purchase a horse and move it to try to avoid that? Not that you can absolutely avoid like insect hypersensitivity, because some horses are just going to have that stressed or not.
For sure. Yeah, there's a definite genetic component there. I think there's some research, right, showing that there's some genetics there. Absolutely. I mean, this is one of those times where, you know, big stressful times are times where it is perhaps useful to be doing some additional gut support products. So, you know, maybe finding a good prebiotic, postbiotic type product that's going to support gut health and keep that GI tract stabilized while you're changing feeds and while you've got all that additional stress would be a good idea. So I really like the various strains of Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast that are out there. That's backed by some good research in horses. And there's a number of good products out there that have Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast in them. And you're looking for about 50 billion CFUs. There's a lot of products that have, you know, a million, 5 million. It's not going to cut it. It has to be tens of billions to really be effective. And that's where the research is. So something like that, that I would add as a top dress would be a good idea, because as you mentioned, GI health, your gut is actually one of the largest components of your immune system.
What about omega-3 fatty acids and supporting the immune system by supplementing those?
Yeah, I mean, they're always useful, right? I mean, they have a nice sort of, they support the inflammatory response to certain things. So if you have a horse that might be a little sensitive, I think that's definitely, it certainly doesn't hurt to provide a source of omega-3 fatty acids. And actually, last week I was at a fabulous conference held by Kentucky Equine Research, and there were some great sessions talking about omega-3 fatty acids and how effective or not plant-based omega-3s are converted to the active EPA and DHA form that really is where the sort of anti-inflammatory action happens, and that a lot of our plant-based omega-3s in the face of also having a lot of omega-6 in the diet don't get converted very effectively. So if you really want good omega-3 support, you really are looking for those EPA and DHA products, which are fish oil-based products. There are some algal products too that have some amount of EPA and DHA in them, but it was really interesting research. We'll have to do an episode on omega-3s.
We do. Fat. And I know when we've talked about them before, I'm always like fish, like the fish oil thing just really breaks my brain, but I know that isn't. Yeah.
No, the research they shared is fascinating, and some really interesting other fatty acids too that we don't think about very often. So yeah, we should do an episode about fat.
We'll put it on the list.
Yeah.
So your horse is getting the omega-3s potentially for immune support, some probiotics and prebiotics. I think really quickly, if you could explain the difference between those two, because it can get a little confusing.
Yeah, so probiotics are live and have the ability to reproduce in the digestive tract, right, and sort of repopulate the gut. That's probiotics. And prebiotics are, I always think of them as being the things that the bacteria like to live on or help stabilize the environment to help the existing bacterial population flourish and be more effective. So that's sort of the big difference. Then there's now postbiotics as well. And postbiotics are the kind of all of the metabolites and everything that come out of those. So if you take a Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast, for example, and like you just blow it up and explode it, like you get all of the metabolites and all the bits and pieces from that cell, and they all have benefits to the host animal that you're then providing that product to. So those are the three classifications we see the most. I don't do so much with probiotics. I mean, there are some encapsulated probiotics out there, but I'm mostly looking at prebiotics and postbiotics as helping to just kind of stabilize the existing gut population in the face of stress.
So if you get this horse and they've been on pasture before you get them, and then you move them across, I mean, you only move the horse 6 hours or so, but drastically different climate. And that's the same where I live up in Oregon. I'm in the high desert. You can buy a horse from over in the valley, 3 hours away. They're used to being on pasture. You bring them over here, they're probably going to be on dry lot, or vice versa if they go the other direction. What do you do in the face of that kind of change for a horse?
Yeah, that's can be a little tricky. I mean, if you're going from dry lot to pasture, then I think you need to follow all the guidelines that are out there for how you introduce a horse to pasture slowly, right? And, or maybe you're taking a horse from a stalled environment environment and you're going to have pasture, you know, that needs to be done slowly. And we normally recommend, you know, like 15-minute increments per day, I think, until you get to like 4 hours of continuous feeding. And then you can kind of go from there. Going the other way, if you're going from a turnout situation to a stalled situation, which is sort of what happened. So the horse that I bought was stalled, but he lived out, you know, 7-8 hours a day in turnout. And we have somewhat limited turnout in our barn. You know, so I just really looked at how can I get him out as much as possible. I mean, even just things as simple as like putting him in the round pen where he could actually play with the horse on the other side of the round pen, which he thought was the best thing ever. Actually, he could reach three different horses. So it was super cute because he'd like go to like 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock and like play with each one. And he's very playful. And so when the one he was playing with got bored, he just moved to the next one. And just go around
and start making his new friends.
He was making friends, and they were actually friendly. He was not making frenemies. They were actually very friendly, and they were very happy to play with him. But yeah, you know, just finding him turn out where I could, making sure he got out every day, even going out. And I couldn't ride for the first 10 days because I didn't have a saddle that fit.
Oh, there's another change. There's another change to the horse's face.
Right. And I don't regret not being. It was so tempting to just leap on a ride, but it was great because I got time to really make a relationship with him and really kind of get to know him a little bit and for him to chill out. And, you know, honestly, he was pretty up when he arrived, and I'm not as young as I used to be. So I was like, wait, it's fine. We'll just look at the chickens.
Yeah.
You know, and so it just gave him time to kind of chill out. And as I said, by the time he was coming out of his stall with his ears at my shoulder height, I'm like, oh, this is a horse I'd get on. And then it was like, not a big deal. So yeah, providing him with those opportunities, getting him out, maybe hand walking him in the morning and, you know, then going back in the evening and doing something else with him and just kind of realizing that he's used to getting out a lot. And then stall toys. So I have a hay ball. So I would, you know, fill that up and put that in there. And, you know, I hung something from the ceiling of his stall for him to mess around with and, you know, things to stall toys and things just to kind of keep him occupied since he wasn't getting out as much as he was used to.
Yeah. And so diet wise, if they're going, you mentioned transitioning them to pasture, but what if you're transitioning them away from pasture? They're going from having pasture where they're grazing to not having that. Like at my place, my horses are turned out, but they're mostly on large dry lots because we just don't have irrigation, and so they don't have grass. Is there anything that might be missing from their diet in that transition?
Yeah, I mean, certainly horses that have been maintained on really good quality pasture, it's going to be abundant in omega-3 fatty acids, like we were just talking about, and vitamin E as well, right? So vitamin E is very abundant in fresh pasture, and it's good quality pasture, and it's not obviously going to be, if you're relying on hay, it's not so available in hay because it's not heat stable. So, you know, if you're feeding commercial feeds properly, you should have enough basic vitamin E going in there. But I think we did a whole episode on vitamin E, didn't we?
We did.
So yeah, definitely people should go listen to that one. But yeah, once you've had the horse, so I actually just did a vitamin E test on Dart, and he was, you know, so the range, normal range was 2 to 4. And oh gosh, I can't remember the units. Anyway, 2 to 4. So I'll raise my brain stretched off for the afternoon. But he was like 2.18. And I'm like, okay, well, that's pretty marginal. I mean, it's like barely normal. And, you know, he's a little weak in the top line. And top line is, you know, vitamin E is important for muscle development. So I wasn't surprised. And that's actually one of the things that motivated me to test him. And so, yeah, so that's certainly something I'll be looking to add in some extra vitamin E. Because he's actually getting about twice his requirement just from the grain he's being fed. And I didn't change his grain from what he was getting at his past owner. And so he's been getting twice his requirement for a long time. So it should have been enough. So for his vitamin E to be that low, he's going to need some vitamin E supplementation.
Yeah. Well, since he didn't come from that far away, you were able to feed the same that mm-hmm. he was getting fed.
Yeah.
If they are moving, and we talked about that changing and getting a bag of what they had and transitioning them, but how do you know what to transition them to?
Yeah, so that's where it's useful. If you can look up online, like what the ingredients are in the thing that he's been fed, you could try and find something as similar as possible or with similar ingredients. You know, so he was being fed 4 pounds of a low NSC senior feed, right? He's actually being fed Triple Crown Senior. And he was a little on the lean side, came off the trailer a little lean. As I said, I wasn't riding him. He wasn't working the first 10 days. And you've got a horse that's mostly being stalled. And so you'd kind of think, oh, I need to cut the grain. But, you know, that was a low NSC, high fat feed, and he needed to gain some weight. And so I wasn't concerned about keeping him at the poundage that he had been on with that feed. But had he been on a higher starch, higher NSC performance type feed in that situation, I might have cut it down. and where in that situation I would normally then add a ration balancer as well, just to kind of balance the two out, not wanting to add something new on top of all the stress. I would have probably just cut it down and not worried about it. I mean, you know, the horse is not, the horse can live for like a week, 2 weeks on a diet that's not perfectly optimal. Did I say that out loud? Shh. It's like, a, you know, don't tell anyone, right? But yes, it's going to be okay. You can, you know, they can live with a slight deficiency in some copper and zinc and some things for a couple of weeks. They'll be fine, you know, and then you can gradually, once they've settled in, you can kind of figure out their personality. And, you know, it's funny, when I was a kid, my mom, who was not a nutritionist, but she's a great horsewoman, she would always kind of feed the horses down a bit, right? She always fed them for great condition, but she never fed them anything very exciting, as she used to refer to it. I'm going to feed them all boring food. Because she maintained that, you know, you don't have a relationship with this horse yet. And the last thing you really need is the thing bouncing off the walls when you don't know it, right? So she was always kind of like, let's feed the new horses, just kind of get them what they need and have it be boring. Like in her book, I mean, we were all kids and she was feeding kids horses and adult amateur horses and things. But in those situations where you don't know the horse, you'd rather be kind of having to kick a little more than getting run away with and bucked off. So,
yeah,
you know.
Well, as you're transitioning the horse, then, I mean, obviously you gave your horse some time off because you were waiting for that new saddle to show up. But if you are going to put them more directly into work without the downtime, I do, I think that the downtime is really a good idea. But if they do need to get to work, how does that fit into the equation of what to feed the new horse at the new place? Like, how do you know, like, what kind of workload they were getting before versus the workload that you'll have them in? And how does that affect what you're going to feed them?
So these are other great questions you're going to have asked the seller before you purchase the horse,
but
right?
Everyone thinks their horse is in a heavy workload.
Oh, I know. But you have to ask the right questions, right? So, yeah. I mean, don't ask yes-no questions, right? You want to ask questions whereby there's a conversation that ensues afterwards, right? So, you know, asking, so like, for example, when I do my consultations with people, I don't ask, well, I do ask, I say, how hard is your horse working? And people often say hard work. And then I ask them, please describe a typical week's work. And then if I'm in a phone conversation, I'll be like, okay, well, how long is that for? Because you're riding for 60 minutes. Well, how much of that is walk, trot, canter? You know, so really get into the detail of it, because then you start to realize, wow, this is a horse. And so, for example, you know, this horse I purchased, I typically ride 4 days a week. Like I don't have, you know, I may not be around. I may be out of town for work a couple of days a week or whatever. So I need a horse who's okay only getting ridden 4 days a week. And some horses need 6 days a week. They need to get out and move. Or, you know, because we don't have the turnout, getting them out means riding. So I need a horse that's okay with maybe just being hand walked 2 days a week and that's it, right? So that was a really important question for me to ask the seller. What kind of work does this horse need? And would he be okay being, you know, only ridden 4 days a week? Yeah, so it's important to know those kinds of things. So once you know how hard you're going to work them, I mean, then we get into put a weight tape on them and condition score them and, you know, start to get an estimate of how much they weigh and figure out, okay, well, what is, you know, we try to feed 1.5 to 2% of their body weight per day is hay. Well, once you have a weight on them, you can figure out what that is. So that at least then sets how much hay you're kind of feeding. And it just takes some diligence of paying attention, right? I mean, like I was told he got 9 flakes of Bermuda. Now, I didn't ask how much they weighed. Person selling was a busy professional. Like I just, you know, I didn't want to bug them and kind of push too much and say, can you weigh that for me? But I know that Bermuda, you know, a good sized Bermuda flake can weigh 6 pounds. A small sized Bermuda flake can weigh 2 to 3 pounds. So even if that was 9 small flakes, that's still 36 pounds of Bermuda a day. That's a huge amount of hay. Now, I don't know that he was eating that, but I also didn't want to get him and then be like, here's 20, right? So there was a little bit of play. It was sort of like, well, let's feed him 2 to 3 flakes in the morning and 2 to 3 flakes in the evening and just watch. Yeah, the first 3 days, there was a lot of Bermuda being used as bedding. So then we cut him back, right? So it's just trial and error. You can't be rigid. You don't know them well enough to be rigid.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned condition scoring them on, so that's the Hennecke, the 1 to 9. 5 is like a nice average, healthy-ish horse. The higher you go, the more obese, and 1 would be emaciated, probably barely alive. But I find that just taking a picture of the horse when they first show up, or having the picture during the pre-purchase exam and then documenting. I had a young horse that I keep for my trainer who she came from a starvation situation. And so that's the first thing we did, was take pictures of her in that initial condition. And it's pretty amazing to look back at the progress that she made, but that documentation really helps. And you just can see things that maybe you didn't see in real time.
Absolutely. No, I have confirmation photographs. So I stand them up like for confirmation and I take a photograph, and I take a photograph from the non-main side because I can see the neck shape top line better when I don't have the main in the way. And then I take one standing, stand them square behind, and take one from the back end of them, the butt looking forward. And that's, yeah, you can really see changes of condition over time. So no, that is a really, it's a good thing to do.
We've talked about the stress involved with this transition, the stress of their life, the stress of their feed changes. When I think of stress, I think of gastric ulcers. So did you have that conversation with your vet or your pre-purchase vet about avoiding gastric ulcers during the transition time?
Yeah. So I knew that I wanted to sort of take every precaution to avoid that, because I knew that this is a classic time that ulcers can, you know, moving to a new barn is a classic ulcer situation because of the stress, like you said. And so when I did the pre-purchase, when I decided to purchase the horse, I then had them do, fill out a health certificate and what have you. And I actually had them leave a tube of, I think it was Gastroguard, with the seller. And when you're using that as a preventative dose, there's four doses in a tube, right? So that gave her, she started it 4 days before he shipped. He got the last dose the day he shipped. And then I bought two tubes on my end and kind of kept doing that for, you know, the 12 days. I gave me 12 days. I think I have three tubes actually. I had 12 days worth to kind of get me through the first couple of weeks at our location. And it's important that you, I think a big mistake people make is like they go to a show or they're shipping to the new barn and they're like, oh, so today we're shipping today. Here's some Gastroguard, right? It doesn't work that quickly. It actually, the research shows it takes like 3 days to be effective. So you have to start it like several days before you're going to go anywhere for it to have any real effect. Otherwise, he would have shipped, had all the stress of being on the road for 6 hours, and then arrived at our barn, day two at our barn. It wouldn't have been until day three at our barn that it would have kicked in, and we could have already had ulcers by that point.
Yeah. Or you never know if they have ulcers before you even get
that
them.
That too. Yeah.
So I want to clarify, because the ulcer guard, Gastroguard thing can be very, very, very confusing. Very yes. confusing. Gastroguard and ulcer guard. So Gastroguard is the label for the treatment dose, and ulcer guard is the preventive dose. Both are omeprazole, and both are the only FDA-approved drugs for treating or preventing gastric ulcers in horses. So that's very important, and it has to do with how the paste is, how the omeprazole is encapsulated, and then it's delivered. And I'm not a veterinarian. I'm just a horse owner who has dealt with this a lot.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, oftentimes, because vets are dealing with treating horses for ulcers, what they have on their rig is Gastroguard.
Is Gastroguard, yeah.
So that's what I got, is I got it from the vet. I got a tube of Gastroguard. However, I purchased two tubes of UlcerGuard from Amazon.
Yeah, because it's available over the counter.
Exactly.
And it's the same manufacturer, and you just look at the instructions, consult with your veterinarian, because it is a drug, but you can get it over the counter
right.
if you need to.
I do have a tip on that, because I'm not convinced when you buy UlcerGuard from the likes of, say, Amazon, that it's always still in date.
I know. So I was going to say that, but I didn't want to call you out on our podcast, Claire. So like, I just bought a lipstick from Amazon. See, maybe I shouldn't call out Amazon either. but the lipstick, I think we had an episode where we talked about rancid feeds.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned to you either in that episode or during our prep that, you know, lipstick will go rancid because of the fat. And I got a rancid lipstick from my Amazon order. And so that's what came to mind when you said you were getting.
Yeah. So I would just caution people, because I think I got a tube that may actually have technically expired. And that's not this time around. That was like back last year when I purchased some for a different horse. So you can get it at your local feed store, because it is over the counter. And at least then you can check the boxes and make sure the date code on them is still current.
Yeah. And if you get them from your vet, you're getting a product that's been handled and managed and stored by a vet. And so that control and custody of that product is more assured than if you're getting them maybe from a random shop that sells on Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, just as to the wise, you know, be aware.
Yeah, no, we did. And that is our spontaneous discussion on that.
Right.
But prevent those ulcers, because it just, then if your horse, your new horse gets ulcers, and then you're trying to do saddle fit, and you're trying to ride them and you're establishing your relationship on their back and their stomach's bothering them, I just think it can really set you up for...
Oh, it just makes me feel sad thinking about
it. Some challenges, yeah. So definitely recommend that. Look to the welfare of the horse when you're making those changes. So
on that line, I mean, even though I had a pre-purchase done and everything looked good, I had my local vet come out not long after he arrived. And he's actually just recently had dental work done and some other things done as well. Just for that, you know, to your point of like trying to set our relationship up in the best way possible from the get-go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to everyone who is horse shopping, try to enjoy the process. I think it's very challenging.
It can be a really long process, speaking from experience.
Oh, man, it is. But then, you know, it can be really rewarding when you find that right horse at the end of the long, long search and all of the traveling and test ride.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My Facebook feed changed totally after I bought this horse because for months, my Facebook feed had been dominated by all the random horse selling groups on Facebook. And I just kind of hid them all because I was like, you know, it's Murphy's Law the week after you buy your horse that something that you would have really, really been amazingly perfect, you know, kind of gets advertised or whatever. And I just didn't want to have that happen. So I just shut them all down. And my whole Facebook feed changed. It was kind of funny.
Well, do you have anything else to add about buying a horse and feeding your new horse before we get to our listener question from our previous episode?
No, not really. But I think, you know, I just challenge everybody to be really honest about what you're looking for in a horse, right? And what you can really handle, what you can really enjoy, what you can really offer a horse. You know, I think that's really important. I try very hard when I'm horse shopping to make sure that what I'm looking for and what I'm looking at actually align. And a good friend of mine who's a trainer and who, you know, kind of kept her eyes open for me, you know, I explained what I was looking for and I explained, you know, the kinds of horses I was looking at. And she just kind of like, she paused and she goes, wow, like your goals and what you're looking for are actually aligned. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, that rarely happens. So I just put it out there, you know, just I think it's really important. And I think it becomes a welfare issue because I think it's one of the ways that horses end up being passed around is when we don't spend the time to really look at what is it we really need and what is it we can really offer. Because when those two things don't align with what we purchase, often it's the horse that loses out.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good perspective. And there's a lot of flash and dazzle. And it's as a middle-aged person, it's fun to watch for the dressage horses. It's fun to watch the pros ride that, but my back says no, thank you.
So right, exactly. No, I'm right there with you. So yeah, I feel lucky that so far I have a horse that every time I get on, I'm just kind of like, I want to go for a gallop across a field. You know, he makes me, you know, he kind of bring, you know, and I'm not sitting there going, oh my God, I can't stop, you know, kind of thing. Like that's the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, well, we have a listener question.
We do.
So our listener said, I love the podcast and found the one on ration balancers and senior feeds particularly helpful. Thank you for loving the podcast. We're blushing a little bit. The question is it okay to mix and match products from different feed companies? For example, can you use a ration balancer in addition to a senior feed when the recommended feeding rate of the senior feed is too much for your horse? Can you mix different feed companies when doing this, or should you stay in the same feed company line because their products are designed to work together? For example, I feed Buckeye Senior Balancer and Triple Crown Senior feed. Does it matter?
Cool. So two good questions I'm hearing there, which is, can I feed a balancer and a senior together, right? And that's actually a great question. And it really does tie those two episodes that we did nicely together. So, you know, we talked about in the ration balancer episode that ration balancers typically have like a 1 to 2 pound a day serving size. And if you need to feed more than that, you don't feed 3-4 pounds of it, right? Because it's really highly fortified and you'd be like overdosing on a bunch of vitamins and minerals that you just don't need at that higher level. And then a lot of senior feeds and performance feeds, you know, their minimum serving sizes start at about like 6 to 8 pounds a day for an average size horse. So what do you do when you have the horse that kind of needs 4 pounds of senior feed to keep itself in perfect condition, right? Knowing that that's not enough and that you're going to be deficient in some vitamins and minerals because you're not following the feeding directions. So this listener is actually doing a perfect job, because what she's done is she's feeding her senior at less than the recommended amount. And knowing that that means that she has a diet that's slightly deficient, she's added a small amount of ration balancer in there to kind of make up that deficit. So it sort of becomes a titration, right? It's sort of like 1 to 2 pounds of ration balancer and no senior or performance feed, or like whatever the minimum serving size is on the performance feed or senior, like say 6 pounds and no ration balancer. And in between the two, you sort of titrate the two, you know, against each other to kind of create a diet overall that gives you the calories you need to maintain body weight and then is also making sure that you have all the vitamins and minerals. So yeah, no, she's doing a good job there.
That question was from Tammy, and she sent it in over email. So we appreciate you, Tammy. Hopefully that is helpful.
And as far as should you stick within certain feed companies' lines, I don't think so necessarily. I mean, when I look at a feed company's lines, I think most, for example, most of the national brands, you know, there's something in each of those companies' lines that I like, right? That I'm like, oh, I really like that feed. Like they do that feed really well. And then maybe I'm like, yeah, don't quite like their performance feed quite so much, or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason that is about those feeds. And so, yeah, I might pick and choose from different companies. Certainly, you know, when you're doing what Tammy's doing, sort of titrating one off the other, it is a good point. So as an example, I'm thinking about like probiotic type packages that get put in feed where you need, like I said earlier, like that 50 billion a day of CFUs. Well, if you've picked the balancer because you really like that prebiotic package, but then you're not feeding enough of the senior to get the full dose of the prebiotic package, they're probably putting the same prebiotic package in their balancer, right? So by putting those two together, to Tammy's point, she's exactly right. Like they are kind of designed to work together.
Yeah, complementing each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of that nutritional technology that some feed brands are putting in their feeds, if you don't feed the full amount of one of their feeds and then substitute in a different companies, you may or may not actually get the full benefit. So I do think that while I certainly do pick and choose feeds from different companies every now and again, I do think there's a lot of value to actually, if you're going to do the kind of balancer and performance feed thing, staying within a brand can have some benefits too.
Yeah. I know my feed bins, I have a mix of different brands. You know, I have a hay pellet that's from one company. I have a senior feed and a ration balancer from another. And then I have an omega-3 fatty acid supplement from a different one.
Right.
So that's how I end up rolling it. Partly has to do with what's available at my feed store on any given
right,
day.
Right, that too.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Tammy, for your question and Claire for your answer. That is all the time we have for this episode. If you are horse shopping, again, good luck. Enjoy the process. We hope we've offered you some good information about bringing your new horse home, keeping them comfortable, and starting that relationship together.
Yeah. If you have any questions about feeding your new horse, you can contact us at info@scoopandscale.com. That's scoop and spelled out scale.com.
Yeah. And you can find Claire at clarityequine.com.
And please make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and share on your social media platforms. It's the biggest compliment when we see people sharing with their friends.
Yep. And we definitely have a growing audience. So people seem to be tuning in to listen to our conversations about horses, Claire.
They are.
For the Scoop and Scale podcast, I'm Michelle Anderson.
And I'm Dr. Claire Tunis.